All right. Well, good morning, everyone, and welcome to our first edition of The Real World of Real Estate, where we will discuss anything and everything to do with this exciting world of real estate. I'll interview top producers, economists, regulators, like today, for example. We'll discuss investing, consumer issues, who knows, maybe even discuss some of the TV quote-unquote reality shows around real estate, anything and everything of interest in the real world of real estate. I thought I'd tell you a bit of an introduction about why I chose this name and why Brian Dewey, the communications manager at Rica, is my first guest. The two kind of go hand in hand. And I should add that Rica, R-E-C-A, stands for the Real Estate Council of Alberta, the regulatory body in Alberta, Canada, for our industry. So I've been an instructor. I was an instructor for the Real Estate Training Institute for area for many years in the licensing program. Sorry, after so many years in an industry, you just throw acronyms around without thinking. AREA stands for Alberta Real Estate Association. And one day in class, we were talking about the rules and regulations around real estate. And one student, he said to me, he said, "No, Gerald," he said, "tell us about the real world of real estate." And he was implying that, you know, all these rules and regulations, I mean, who listens to that kind of stuff? And, you know, we got to get business done. And it was a good question, and I had to think about it. He kind of caught me by surprise, and I didn't know how to answer it. And I thought about it for a second or two, and I thought, no, you know what? I said, this is the real world of real estate. Anybody that goes out and practices in an unsavory manner is only fooling themselves. And this is indeed the real world of real estate. And on that note, I thought it'd be very appropriate to have the Real Estate Council of Alberta as my first guest. So I want to welcome Brian Dewey, Communications and Connection Manager. Good morning, Brian.
Good morning, Gerald. How's it going?
Good, thanks. And how are you today?
I'm doing excellent. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks very much for coming on, being my first guest. I appreciate it. Why don't you give us a bit of a short introduction to yourself, and then we'll give a brief outline of some of the things we'll chat about today.
Sure thing. Thanks. Well, as you said, I'm Brian Dewey. I'm the Communications and Connections Manager at the Real Estate Council of Alberta. I've been at RECA for 13 years now. Started out as the communications lackey, as they say. And then worked my way up, and now I'm the manager. In that time, the industry's gone through a lot of changes, and I've been there for all of them. It's been a ton of fun. And actually, prior to that, prior to RECA, I actually worked at the Calgary Real Estate Board. I was the managing editor of the Calgary Real Estate News newspaper for a couple of years. So my entire professional career has actually been in real estate in some way, just not selling houses.
Oh, well, there you go. Well, some of the questions I have for Brian today, some of the things I thought we'd talk about are probably relevant to all of us, both agents and consumers. You know, disclosure requirements around the agency, that kind of stuff, duties to clients and customers, disclosure of defects, the rules and the laws around that. And then social media, with the rise of social media becoming such a dominant form of communications these days. And then anything else at the end, if there's time for anything else, we'll chat about anything else. So on that note, Brian, do you want to start in and tell us a bit about the disclosure requirements for agents, or do you want me to give you some scenarios? What I've got rolling around in my head is kind of the logical first step to the logical last step. So I'm just meeting a customer for the first time, say, or chatting on the phone, you know, and as we chat, maybe they'll ask me something requiring skill and expertise, or maybe they'll give me some confidential information. So I don't know, best way to attack that. What do you think?
Well, we can scenarios are probably a little more, get us into the nuts and bolts of the matter. Okay. I would think.
All right. So, okay. So I'm meeting someone for the first time, the possibility of either selling their property or helping them to buy or lease a property. And we start chatting. When does a disclosure requirement kick in, and what actual disclosure requirement does kick in?
Well, disclosure of your potential role and what roles you could take with them if you were to work with them, that would kick in when you're just chatting idly or not when you shake their hand or anything like that and say hello. It would be when you are going to be offering any sort of the services that you would offer a client or a customer. And that could include, like you said, maybe they start giving you confidential information about why they're buying or something like that, or why they're wanting to sell or something like that. You know, you can put the brakes on a conversation like that just for a second, and let them know that you doing this for a job and, you know, remuneration involved and all that. You can let them know that there are certain steps you have to take to create a relationship if they're going to continue the conversation.
Okay.
It's as simple as that, really.
And if the conversation continues and we start going down that road of a relationship, at what point in time does the disclosure requirement kick in that it has to be in writing?
Well, that would be when you're going to be signing the agreement, right? So if you stop that conversation and you let them know that to continue, they're going to have to set out exactly what your role with each other is going to be, then that's when you bring out the consumer relationships guide that you're required to provide them.
Yeah.
So it's just the straightforward document that explains the different levels of service, really, and the not different levels of service, right? Like the different relationships that you can have with an industry professional, and going so far as to explain things like what could happen if there was a conflict of interest and how that would be solved with transaction brokerage. It's very simple, and providing them with that right away, and getting their signature that they have understand what is contained in that and what the potential roles could be, then you would get right into your written service agreement. And when in doubt, write it out. So if you're thinking that you know, wondering in your head, oh, should I stop this conversation and get into a formal written agreement? Then, hey, why not?
Good old when in doubt applies in a lot of things. When in doubt, disclose, right? Same thing.
Yeah. Oh, exactly.
Now it's getting better, but in the beginning it was a little difficult because a lot of consumers, you know, you just meet them and all of a sudden you're pulling a piece of paper out and saying, sign this. But for any consumers listening in, the disclosure is not a contract, correct? It's just me doing my duty, proving that I've done my disclosures and that they're well informed. Is that correct?
Yeah, the consumer relationships guide is just that. It's called that in the rules. It's called the consumer relationships guide. It is not an agreement. It is simply showing that you have discussed these various relationship options with potential clients or customers, and that they are signing off that they understand what was in the document and that you talk to them about it.
Okay.
It's really just about informed consent. So when you go on to make an actual agreement, they have already shown that they understand the relationship that they are agreeing to in the agreement. And there's no one who can say, oh, I didn't understand.
All right. Okay, so now we continue on and we decide that we want to work together. There's correct me if I'm wrong, there's two forms to work together, exclusive or non-exclusive. What are the different disclosure requirements in those two scenarios? Commercial and residential is different, correct? In residential, it's must, and commercial, it's should. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. Written service agreements are mandatory, whether they're a buyer or a seller, in residential real estate, and in mortgage brokerage and in property management. But commercial real estate, yeah, you're right, it's just should be encouraged, and it's in the rules that they're encouraged to have a written service agreement because it just sets everything out in paper and it makes it so there's fewer conflicts later on if everyone has agreed to what's going to happen in all instances, you know, ahead of time.
You know, and really if both parties decide they want to work together, isn't it usually it's in everyone's best interest to have everything laid out in writing what our expectations of each other are? Wouldn't that be is that an accurate statement?
Yeah. That's a very accurate statement. Getting it in writing, everyone knows what the other side is going to do, and everyone knows how you're going to communicate, how you're going to get paid as the professional. And having that in writing, as I said, will create way fewer disagreement later on should something happen. And you can say, well, we agreed to that in writing here. And hopefully you wouldn't even get to that point because the consumer would also understand what they agreed to in the agreement. And then they wouldn't, if something happened later on that maybe didn't go their way, they would understand that that could have been a possibility right up from the beginning because it's in the agreement.
Now, when someone becomes our client, try and run this off the top of my head here, see if I can remember it all. The duties that we owe a client by law, reasonable care and skill, obedience and obedience to their legal instructions, full disclosure.
Yeah.
Do you know the fourth one?
Oh, I have undivided loyalty.
Right?
The confidentiality. Full disclosure, obedience, reasonable care and skill, and full accounting.
Okay. And by full accounting in real estate, we don't do their bookkeeping for them. It's just if they walked into the office and said, where's my money? We'd have to show a paper trail proving it's in the right place, basically.
Yes, and not just money, documents, keys, a full account of all the money and property that you receive while acting on their behalf.
Okay. And you know, that's a good point there about the deposits. How are we doing as an industry with getting deposits in on time?
I'm not sure. I don't think it's been a common problem based on our decisions that are publicly available on our website.
Okay.
That's one of the areas it would seem that, you know, a lot of people would take the most seriously is when someone hands you a check for thousands and thousands of dollars.
All right.
And we do have... And that's held in trust. And we do have an entire department that is our trust auditors who go in and check brokerages, trust accounts on a regular basis. So if there's something going wrong there, our auditors tell them right away. And hopefully everything is corrected.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. So now seller is my client. And a consumer calls me directly on my listing and wants to buy my listing through me. Now that starts to create a different scenario. I have to go back to my client. I have to get in writing consent from both parties. Let's say the buyer says, I want you to work for me also. And then I get into transaction brokerage. I need written consent from both sides. Otherwise the buyer stays as a customer and they need a customer disclosure. Full disclosure of my relationship with the seller. How does that play out?
Well, if that happens, and this is, you should let the person know right away that you're going to have to do these things when they call you. But in all honesty, the transaction brokerage situation should kind of be your last resort, because entering a transaction brokerage situation where you are going to facilitate the transaction between this new buyer and your existing client seller. If you do that, then you're no longer acting in your original client's best interest because you've just removed all of your ability to advise them during the negotiation. So, you know, hopefully you would have a discussion first about what other options you could do instead of that. But that would always be on the table as something you could do in the end. But as you said, both parties would have to agree to that in writing before you proceeded in any way. And we have those, and there are agreements that outline that structure available, usually from your board or from RECA. We have example forms of that as well. But before you get to that point, you would want to, you know, there's other options you can do to solve the conflict. I mean, you would disclose that it would be a conflict right away to both parties, and then you would want to get their instructions on how to proceed, your original client. But one of the options that you could do is, say, have someone else, if you're in a designated agency brokerage where each agent can be the designated agent and the client is the client of everyone at the brokerage, then you can move them to a different designated agent within your brokerage, the new people. Or you could say, oh, go call a different brokerage and tell the buyer to go contact a different brokerage, and they could use a different brokerage to come in to the transaction. as you know, options that would allow you to continue to have a client relationship with all the fiduciary duties with your original client proceed with the transaction. But if they're comfortable with it after you explaining that that would be the case, that you could no longer advise them, then and they're okay with that and just want you to facilitate the transaction and get it done, then you could proceed with that written transaction brokerage agreement, and that way everyone is on the same page and understands your role and how it would all play out.
Okay, so if we're in a designated agency brokerage, another agent from my office can assist the buyer. If we're in common law, then they should go to another brokerage.
I don't know about should, but that would be an option for your original client to decide if that's how they would like to proceed.
Oh, okay.
If they don't want to say, no, I don't want transaction brokerage, go tell the buyer they're going to have to bring in their own representation or not be represented.
Okay. All right.
Or something like that, right?
Yeah. So transaction brokerage is our last resort because basically you're not representing anybody.
Basically, you're facilitating the transaction.
Okay.
And people say dual agency, it used to be called, but you're not really an agent for both. You're an agent for neither at that point. And right. You're really just facilitating the transaction.
Okay. And of course, the original client, the seller, has the right to say, no, I don't approve of the transaction brokerage situation. And then the buyer has to go and find their own representation.
That's right. Yeah, you always have to obey your client's instructions and get their informed written consent to do the transaction brokerage.
Okay. All right.
The key there is informed.
Right.
That's to say, the key is informed consent. They have to understand what they're agreeing to.
Informed, timely, and in writing. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right. Timely, right away, informed, let them know exactly what's going to happen, and then get those signatures.
Well, can't I just get them to sign everything after the deal? It's so much easier for me.
No, you absolutely cannot. And that is something that happens. We do get complaints from consumers about that, and even our auditors, when they go in and check brokerage paperwork, and they see the date on a transaction brokerage agreement is like at the exact same time as other agreements. And so that they have to question that, right?
Yeah.
It's, sometimes, as you say, people just thought, we got this deal on the table. It's all ready to go. Just sign this other document. That's not how it has to be done. Your clients have to get their informed consent and have to know what's going on. And it can't just be done after.
So the key things for everyone to remember is consent must be informed. In other words, we need to sit down and have the conversation. It must be timely. I can't do it after the transaction. Say, oh, by the way, I need you to sign this. And it must be in writing. Those are the three those are the three components, correct?
Correct.
Okay. All right. So now let's say I'm selling my own property or a property I have an interest in, or I'm buying a property on my own behalf. If the person, let's say I'm selling my own property I guess it doesn't matter either way. But it's different. What I have to do is different depending on whether or not the other person is represented or unrepresented?
Not really. You'd, as I understand it, you would have to disclose that you are a licensed, whatever your class is, a licensed real estate associate. And you'd have to disclose that right away. And I believe you have to indicate what brokerage you work for. Yeah, I think in either case, you would have to disclose that right away.
Okay, yeah. And there's no extra, if the person is unrepresented, they come to me, I'm selling my house, I got to tell them, hey, listen, it's my house, I'm not your agent, we got to go through any extra disclosure, or just the same disclosure requirements in both regards?
I think it would be the same. You would have to say that, but then you would have to, for someone who's unrepresented, you may say, hey, why don't you bring your own representation? But we, as a regulator, a real estate regulator, we don't regulate buyers and sellers. We regulate the professionals who represent them. Mm-hmm. So we can't really tell buyers and sellers what to do.
Yes. Yeah.
And if you're not in a agency relationship with those buyers, then, you know, you telling them something. We can't make you tell them something, but we can make sure that you disclose certain information, but we can't make you tell them, like give them advice.
Yeah.
Basically.
Yeah, no, I think it's just myself here, but I think there's no argument, at least in my mind, what little extra bit of fees you might put in your pocket by having that person go through you is just not worth the risk of, you know, maybe you don't properly, you don't give them some good advice when they needed good advice, or the trouble that you can get into, you know, it's just not worth it. I don't know if I'm wording that right. It's better to have them represented. Go get representation. It's the best thing for them. It's the best thing for me. Everybody has their own independent advice at the end of the day. I don't know if I'm wording that well.
Yeah. Well, when you are, and really just popped in my head, actually, when someone is unrepresented, you know, they won't have certain knowledge like that they should ask, like questions they should ask, like someone who's represented would be. So really you would also have to disclose to those unrepresented people who are interested in the property you own, any information that could materially affect the value of the real estate. So it's basically, you'd have to make sure you give those material latent defects. And let's say, no, that's it. Like, yeah, you just, you're right, there is a separate disclosure. You just have to make sure that you're upfront about everything about the property with those unrepresented buyers and sellers, whereas with, and it has to be in writing, and a written disclosure to someone who's represented coming to buy your property, you really just have to disclose that you hold a license with RECA and the name of your brokerage.
You know, and I think for the purposes of my reputation, I just don't want to take that chance, because they're going to ask me something that requires care and skill or a disclosure as a homeowner for, you know, it's just me personally, yeah. I don't want to go down that road. I don't think it's a good road to go down. So yeah, best thing is let everyone.
As you say, with disclosures, with everything, when in doubt, if something niggles in the back of your mind, that maybe there's something I should be doing here, maybe do that thing.
Okay. Now, even if an agent does work with a customer, and sometimes maybe they're buying through an agent who doesn't have the listing, I'm just helping them as a customer because they don't want to sign anything, or they want to go through me. I had a listing where the buyer was an investor, and so they wanted to come through me in the hopes that I would reduce my fees and they would get a better deal, but that's another story. But for whatever reason, if you're working with a customer, we still owe them three duties. We honesty, care and skill, and I'm trying to think of the third one, but there's three duties. So if a customer wants to work with me, they still are protected by three duties. There's three, right? Honesty, care and skill, and full disclosure.
Yeah, the disclosure, of course. Yeah, so it's honesty, care and skill, reasonable care and skill, and a full disclosure. Yeah, you still have to disclose certain things to your customer, not just to your client.
Okay. All right, so the customers are protected to a degree. We just don't owe them some of the special duties of loyalty and what's the word I'm looking for when they tell me something, confidentiality.
Confidentiality,
So they got to watch. So yeah, if you're a customer, don't tell me, oh, this is how high I'll go.
Yeah.
Okay. Because I have to go straight to my client. I have to tell them that, right?
Well, yeah, absolutely. And when you do have a customer come in the customer acknowledgement form that they have to sign to be a customer, they it says right near the top somewhere like that they're acknowledging that they've chosen not to be represented. It's basically they're not represented. So, and that you don't, as the agent, don't owe them any agency obligations, including the fiduciary obligation.
Okay.
It's really just you have to tell the truth, because you can act dishonestly in any case, in any dealings you're doing as a professional. And ensure anything you tell them is correct and exercise your due care and skill at all times.
Okay. Okay, Brian, let's turn to disclosure of defects. Sure. And again, I'm gonna put myself on the hot spot here. So I think there's a couple different classifications. There's material defects and immaterial defects. and there's patent and latent defects. And if I understand correctly, material latent defects, it's the law, both the seller and the agent must disclose without being asked all material latent defects. And if I understand correctly, all other defects don't have to be disclosed, but if I'm asked, I must answer honestly. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's pretty much right. Yeah, the material latent defects are ones, as you say, even in, so if there is a material latent defect, which we'll define as anything about the property that isn't easily discoverable, that makes a property dangerous, makes it unfit to live in, or unfit for the buyer's purpose, if you happen to know what that is. So if they want to buy, if they are buying it and they tell you they're buying it for to run a home business out of, but you know that there's some special thing about this property that makes that impossible, you have to disclose that that exists. But it is material latent defects. If the seller, if you as a professional know of a material latent defect about your seller's property, and the seller asks you, don't say anything about it, they say, don't say anything about this defect to any potential buyers, you cannot follow that instruction. You must disclose these defects to any buyers or buyers' representatives.
And if they don't let me, I have to discontinue working for them, right?
Basically, I don't think you have to. You just have to, you know, work out how that arrangement is going to end or continue after that.
Okay.
But you must not, you can't follow that instruction.
So the important point here for everyone, consumers especially, and this is the law. I believe this is not just Real Estate Act. I believe this is, I don't know if it's fraud or where it's under, but homeowners must disclose any defects they know of that are of a material nature and that are not easily discoverable, or to use the common word, hidden, I guess, but not easily discoverable also covers things like you mentioned, not just a physical thing, something that I can't use it for a business that I thought I could, right? So those must be disclosed by everybody, consumers, the seller, and the agent, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. But, you know, as I said, we don't regulate the buyers and sellers, so we can't really control if they choose to be dishonest in that situation.
That's off the court,
professionals,
right?
The professionals have to. You know, and then, as you said, these can be things that, like, cracks in the foundation that they know about that are hidden by drywall now. And, like, they know that it rains. When it rains, the basement floods a little, but they keep that hidden from buyers. Or it could be something even like if there was work done on the property that didn't get the proper permits from the municipality where you live. And then, you know, let's say it's plumbing, but then, you know, the buyer can't dig up the floor and look and make sure the plumbing is at, you know, to code. So they can't discover that. So if you don't say that there was any work done, if the buyer says there was no work done, but there had been, but no permits, that's a material latent defect.
Okay. All right. So all other defects. So there could be a defect that's not of a serious nature and it's not up to us. I guess that's up to a court to finally determine that. But there could be a defect of a minor nature, but it's hidden. I don't have to disclose that. The seller doesn't have to. Well, again, you don't regulate sellers. That's the law. But we don't have to disclose that, but we must answer honestly if asked.
That's right. You must always act honestly. That's right in the rules. So, but the sort of caveat here is you can also choose not to answer. So if someone asks you about this defect, you know, if you choose to answer, you must answer honestly about it, but you can also choose not to answer, which in a way kind of answers the question.
Pretty much the same thing, right?
You know, but that's up to the buyer and the buyer's representative to, you know, make that leap of logic. But they, you know, and really, and when you're asked that question, let's say it's just you and the buyer's representative talking, and they ask that question, you wouldn't answer right away, or choose not to answer right away. You would have to have your client's instructions on how they would want you to do it, whether or not you would answer or choose not to answer.
And, you know, that brings up another good point, that as agents, if there's something that we should reasonably know. We see something, we ask the seller about it, and the seller says, oh, my brother knows a guy whose friend's a plumber, and he said it's fine. That doesn't fulfill our duties. That's not good enough, right?
No, that's not. That's still a material latent defect. And then you could do something like advise your seller to contact the municipality and get a permit for the work that's already been done, because municipalities will do that as well.
Or advise them to see, or advise them to talk to an expert and get an expert opinion on the matter.
Okay. Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Anything else on disclosure of defects? I can't think of anything else.
Nothing. I think we've hit all the notes.
Okay.
There's also, like you say, there's other things that aren't a defect. Like a good one is these days that you may come across more is cannabis. So back in a big part of material latent defects back in the day, or like one of the big examples was grow ops.
Right.
And because they created a lot of damage in properties, like structurally and in terms of mold and stuff like that. But now with legal cannabis and with sellers potentially having up to 4 plants in their house for their own purposes, people still sort of call those grow ops sometimes, but 4 plants in the house is no different than 4 tomato plants. So something like that isn't a material latent defect in of itself anymore, like it might have been for like an old grow op with like a bazillion plants in there. It's the damage caused by that would be the defect. But if it hasn't caused any damage because it's just 4 plants in the house, then that's not something you have to disclose as part of material latent defects.
Okay.
That's just something that people might come across more these days.
Okay, I get it. So the existence of 4 cannabis plants doesn't trigger any disclosure. But if I look up on the roof and there's the ceiling and there's mold above it, we might be getting a disclosure area, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes, that's the way to think about it. Exactly. Yeah. It's the damage that makes the property dangerous or unfit to live in, or potentially dangerous. That's the defect. The plants themselves aren't a defect in and of themselves.
Okay. Well, let's get into the fun and exciting world of social media. You know, social media is so prevalent these days, and I think it would be an understatement. I think everyone knows there's a lot of bad behavior out there on social media. And I imagine in a professional context for us as real estate agents, there's things we have to watch out for also, I imagine. Well, I guess there's 2 categories I can think of is 1, advertising, because we advertise through social media. But 2, I'm thinking also general behavior, and in general behavior, we have so-called private groups where we discuss different things and that, you know, the questions I have, is that private? Is that considered public? Are we still under obligation? So those are 2 areas I can think of. Maybe there's other areas that are of interest for us as real estate, really any regulated industry that, you know, mortgage brokers, inspectors, anything you want. I guess I'll leave it to you. Go ahead and comment on that.
Yeah, sure. It is definitely something that Rika has taken an interest in since the beginning of social media, because it is, as you say, it's this new form of advertising is the biggest thing. And we do get a lot of complaints that come in about advertising, particularly on social media. And the 2 big things are clearly indicating a brokerage, which is a requirement for all advertising. It's more difficult to do with the limitations of social media. So a lot of people kind of forget about that and leave it out of their advertising, or think of social media as not being advertising or different somehow. But really, it is advertising your services, and you must have your brokerage name clearly indicated. And the nitty-gritty of that, we do include in our advertising guideline on exactly, you know, where on some of the big social media platforms, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, where you could clearly indicate your brokerage and continue to advertise on social media. And the other one is incentives. A lot of people hold little contests on Facebook, say, saying, you know, like my post and you'll be entered into a draw for a gift card or something like that. but that's an incentive driving business to you, which, as we all know, all incentives that you offer must be brokerage incentives and must be offered by the brokerage, not by an individual professional, and must be available. That same incentive must be available for all associates at a brokerage to use. And a lot of people forget that because they just think, oh, it's just a social media post trying to, you know, and it's just a little gift card, but it's still an incentive and it's still captured by the rules, which state all incentives have to be brokerage incentives. So those two are the real big issues that we come across often with social media.
Are there any ways we can do that, like a like my post thing, without triggering an incentive? Like, because obviously we all want to get our posts liked, we want to get engagement in that. Or is that in the, I should say, first of all, the advertising guidelines can probably be downloaded from your website?
Yes, they can. Yeah, if you just go to Rika.ca and just search advertising guidelines, it'll be the first thing that pops up.
And is there, off the top of your head, is there a way that we can do contests or get people to engage with us without triggering, I guess, don't offer any sort of incentive, basically?
Basically, yeah, no prize.
Okay.
Or potential prize. Or talk to your broker. And I mean, it would be as simple as just having the brokerage offer the prize. Like, there's, it shouldn't be difficult. If you come to your broker, I have this advertising plan. It includes driving engagement on social media, it includes these prize draws. Can we make this a brokerage incentive? And, you know, and that would have to be available to all the other associates, but there's no telling if it's a good idea. Maybe that's a good thing and the broker will agree. But as with a lot of things, your first call should be your broker.
Okay.
To have a chat with it.
And if we did do that, can the broker legally go back? Let's say I do it more than anybody else in the brokerage, and I end up giving out 10 gift cards for $100 each. Can the broker recover that from me, or does that have to be paid by the brokerage and cannot be recovered from me? I shouldn't say recovered. Recovered directly from me. You know, they can raise fees to everybody. I don't know. What's the rules around that?
There aren't any rules from Rika. We don't regulate the relationship that an associate has with their brokerage, like, besides that you're registered with that brokerage, really.
Okay.
We don't regulate what agreements you would have about who is paying for what.
Okay. Any other issues around the advertising, or those are kind of the main things?
Those are the main ones. Yeah, definitely people forgetting to clearly indicate their brokerage in their social media and offering incentives that aren't brokerage incentives. Those are the two big ones.
Now, what about general behavior? I'm an instructor for the Real Estate Institute of Canada, and one of the courses I teach is the ethics course. And often when I'm teaching an ethics course, more than half the folks are there because they have to be there. And there was a recent, I won't say which board, I teach all across Canada online, but there was a recent situation where several agents got involved in an improper social media discussion and off they went to the ethics course. So are you seeing things around general behavior online that we need to know about, not to do, or be careful about?
We are. We've seen there is more of that, and people do bring it to our attention. It's for us, it's tough to regulate because, first we'd have to, you know, make it, you know, like we can't regulate free speech, right?
Right.
So we'd have to, you know, walk that line as well. It depends on what they're saying, how they're saying it, and whether or not they're doing so, like, as a private citizen exercising their right to free speech, or if they are doing it in their professional capacity. That's when we can step in, is when they're saying something quite egregious. And you know, they're doing it from their, you know, John Doe Real Estate Twitter handle, right? Mm-hmm. They're in those instances, then we could say that they are, you know, putting the industry itself into disrepute, which is something you're not allowed to do under the rules.
Now, that's probably a very, very gray line, I imagine. I've got, like so many folks, I've got a personal Facebook account and a professional Facebook account. And I'm guessing I don't have carte blanche to just to go on my personal account and say, oh, I had a client, and the client's an idiot, and here's their name and a picture of them, and, you know, and don't do, like, even though I'm on a personal account, I imagine I still could be held accountable if I egregiously cross the line.
Yeah, I can't speak to that exactly, but it would really depend on the situation, because a lot of this is new, right? There's no case law around it, or there's no, you know, it hasn't been heard by a panel in RICA, that kind of thing. Until we, you know, come across it, and then we build up, you know, decisions from there. And really, I don't know, I don't want to segue into this right away, but the new industry council is coming in, as opposed to the overall council that was ejected under Bill 20. They would be the ones setting the standards and interpreting things for the regulator to either, you know, make a decision on how they're going to prosecute, I guess would be the word, these sorts of situations.
Fair enough. Well, hopefully as little as possible. Yeah. Fair enough. That's still in the works. And you made a good point. You know, we do have free speech, and free speech is a cornerstone of democracy, one of the most highly held rights that we have in a democracy. It's the whole cornerstone that keeps the wheels moving and keeps our society free. But the example I like to use is, you know, it's an old example. You've probably heard it before. Your right to extend your fist ends where my nose begins. So, you know, we have a right to free speech, but free speech isn't a carte blanche to say anything you want, anytime you want. We can injure others. And I don't remember, when you're saying something, is that slander or is that libel? Slanders, one's written, one's verbal. Right. Anyway, the point is we still have to be careful under the law to exercise it in a responsible manner.
Exactly. It's freedom of speech, not freedom from consequences of your speech.
What about private groups, private realtor groups on Facebook, where only members, real estate agents of a certain group are members? Is that considered completely private? We still have to behave as a professional there? I don't mean that the wrong way. I mean, anything around that? Are you able to say anything around that yet, or is that still up in the air?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm able to say anything about that, other than talking on the internet, just always consider it public.
Yeah,
just like it's out there. There's nothing stopping some member of that group from screenshotting the thing you said and sending it out to the world, the wider world. So just always, I mean, and you are acting in a professional capacity. You are a professional who must uphold, you know, certain standards of behavior and professionalism, and that can extend into your gossiping private groups, in all honesty. Just remember that if you're in one of those, treat it as a public space.
Yeah.
And then you'll probably be fine.
Good point. You know, we are free citizens of a democracy, and we have freedom of speech, but we are also professionals, and like all rights in this world, they come with responsibilities, and we have to balance everything in a professional manner, I guess. You know, just because I have the right to do something doesn't make it the right thing to do, I guess.
Yeah, and whether or not RICA can, or a hearing panel or something, can decide whether or not what you said was wrong or not, or whether, you know, what damage it caused or anything like that, that's really secondary. If you did something, said something egregious, and it got out into the wider public, I think the damage that you've done to yourself would be greater than to your reputation and your future business would be greater than whatever RICA would come at you for.
Very good point. Very good point. As professionals, everything we say and do reflects upon us. So, okay. Anything else in the social media area that you wanted to add or wanted to say?
A big thing for everyone to just to think about is their personal versus their professional presence online. And if you have a professional account you use for driving business, understand that all the rules involved with undertaking your regulated profession will come into play. If you wanted, that isn't to say you can't post your vacation picture up on your professional Instagram, but why not have a separate personal account for personal stuff and a professional account for all of your regulated business? Just makes sense to me.
Yeah, and if all else fails, I mean, we can always contact Rika and ask, here's something I want to do. And I know you can't always give us the direct answer, but we can always, I guess if it was something clearly, don't do this, you'd be able to tell us. Is that right?
Well, if you came and said, if you called up our information officers and said, I have this ad and I want to know if it's okay, our information officers will not be able to say that's okay. But what they will be able to do is, let's say it didn't have a brokerage name in it, they wouldn't say, oh, your ad doesn't have a brokerage name, so it's bad. They would say, oh, all advertisements must include the brokerage name.
Okay.
You know, that sort of thing, where they would tell you rules surrounding it, but not tell you whether or not your advertisement is okay by Rika or not.
Yeah.
And I just did air quotes on it, okay.
No, I understand. So they yeah. If I wanted to put something or say something on social media and I wasn't sure if it was okay, they wouldn't be able to help me say, gee, you're okay, go ahead with that? Or would they be able to say, no, that's really borderline? Can they say anything around that?
No, they wouldn't be able to tell you. Like, they're not there to give you advice on what to do. So Rika won't be able to tell you or advise you on your social media posts whether or not they're acceptable or not. They would, but let's say your post could potentially be misleading, they'll advise you that, oh, rule, and I can't remember which rule it is off the top of my head, states that you can't be misleading, you know, or
yes,
advertisements can't be misleading. Here's an information bulletin describing how advertising must not be misleading, but they won't tell you that yours, whether or not your post is okay.
Okay, if they see a spot where they know a rule applies, they can say this rule applies. And if there's clearly...
It's not up to the information officer to say whether or not it's acceptable or not, because maybe it's not.
Okay.
If they say it is, and it turns out it actually isn't, or something they didn't notice, that's not a very good situation.
Okay, and what's the email address to contact the information officers?
No, it's just info@rika.ca.
info@rika.ca. Okay. Well, yeah. Go ahead.
I was just saying, yeah, and there, we answer those emails. If we can't get it on the same day, not right away, they'll at least acknowledge that they've received it. And not an auto reply. They'll acknowledge that they've received it. And if they don't have an answer right away, they'll find the answer and get back to you, you know, whether or not, if that's the next day or something. But they'll try to answer you that same day right away there. And I know a lot of places the info inbox is just like a catch-all for anything,
right?
But ours is manned by people, is operated by two excellent information officers who will be answering you right away.
Okay. Well, that's all I've got for you for questions today. It's been fun and informative. Anything upcoming on the Rika front? Anything you want to inform us? Here's some things upcoming or news items, anything? It's floor is open for you.
Sure. So as we are all aware, the governance situation with the council is changing. Bill 20 came in June, where now instead of a council appointed, like a single council of 12 people appointed to be the, like, from the industry mostly, to be the governance of the real estate council and the governance of the industry. Now there's a board of directors that will be made up of people from who are appointed by the Minister of Service Alberta, three public members, and there'll be four industry representatives who come from industry councils for each different area of real estate. So mortgage, residential property management, commercial and commercial property management, and residential real estate. Those are the four industry councils. And each one of those will have elected members from the industry directly. then they send one representative up to the board of directors that sort of will govern RECA now, or at least when it comes into effect, because none of the Bill 20 changes have come into effect yet. And that is because the government is developing regulations to go along with the Real Estate Act to sort of outline things that are happening and how it will all work with the new governance model. And that's what they're working on right now. There are committees set up to sort of work through all these issues, and they're made up of people from the Service Alberta, from industry associations and other stakeholders, and there's RECA senior staff members on those committees as well. And that's all overseen by a steering committee, which will sort of make final decisions and recommendations. But that's all happening right now, and hopefully this timeline is aggressive and they want to have everything in place for November. So everyone should pay attention to their inboxes for announcements on things like nominating people for these industry councils and undertaking the elections. So everyone should take part in that and make sure that they have a voice in, make sure they do their part in electing a representative to who's going to be basically governing all of the rules and standards of practice in their industry. So keep an eye on your inbox.
How's it looking for the November deadline? Is there a reasonably good chance of meeting it right now at the moment?
I don't know. I can't speak to that. That's a question for the government.
All righty. Well, we'll definitely keep an eye on our inboxes there. And anything else upcoming? Anything other news?
Nope. Just renewals have started. So all the brokers out there, you can renew their brokerages as soon as possible so that all your associates and associate brokers can start renewing. The deadline September 30th, as with every year. And try to do it as early as possible, and so you don't reach the madness of the final week where the vast majority of the industry renews. And let's say you have a problem and you try to get through to us, but so are several hundred other people, and it may not be dealt with in as timely a manner as you would like. So the earlier the better.
All right. Cool. Well, Brian, it's been a pleasure to have you as my first guest here on The Real World of Real Estate. And hopefully some point in the future, anything happens or any big changes, maybe we'll see if we can have you on again. But I want to thank you very much for joining me here today.
Well, thanks for having me, Gerald. It was a pleasure.
All righty, Brian. Thanks very much. Folks, before I end off, let me tell you a bit about what's coming up. I've actually got several guests lined up in the queue, so not sure who's going to get published first. But I'll be speaking with Valerie Gibbs, a chartered financial analyst with RBC PH&N. She'll be talking about alternative investment opportunities. I'll be speaking with Madeline Sarah Finchin from Jamin Homes about the new home market. I've got Councillor Andrew Knack coming up from the City of Edmonton. We'll be speaking about different issues that affect real estate in the Edmonton area. A transportation plan, the planning and development department, transit-oriented development, maybe other things. And I'll be interviewing Jennifer Lucas, president of the Realtors Association. So we've got lots of guests coming up. Stay tuned. We'll see you next week on The Real World of Real Estate.